My name is Ann Smith, and I am here with Edward Kissam, spelled K-I-S-S-A-M, and today's date is April 21st, 2010. We are in one of the meeting rooms of the Millhopper Alachua County Library, and this interview is being done both for the Sam Proctor Oral History Program and the Matheson Historical Museum. No, I don't think I've forgotten anything. Let's start out with where you were born.
I was born in South Carolina, actually at a sawmill in a swamp. The sawmill was on the banks of the Edisto River, and this was off into the woods, about a mile from...
The Edisto River?
Yes, Edisto.
E-D-I-S-T-O. Okay, Edisto.
Edisto River. And it's a very... As a matter of fact, there's an Edisto Island where this river comes out.
Mm-hmm.
My father worked for the lumber company there.
Mm-hmm.
He was a person who was self-taught to be a civil engineer. He had a
right.
sextant and a compass, and he went out to tracks of timber. And ran the lines of where they were supposed to be, and then I'm telling you more about
no, no, that's okay. Exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Okay, he ran the lines, and then he estimated how much timber they could get off this track.
I got it.
And then they had also made him a justice of the peace, and he could sign the papers for the company.
Sure.
So he never went through high school. He was born up in North Carolina on a
mm-hmm.
farm. But I was born there. There was a house there by the sawmill, obviously a house because we lived in it.
Mm-hmm.
And once there was my mother told me once that they had a flood there and they had to go upstairs. So there was a two-story house there.
Uh-huh.
And there probably were other houses, too. I doubt that we were the only.
Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't a big community.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently, we left there when I was 1 year old. The family did and went to Orangeburg, South Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And I was taken back there when I was 5 years old. There was nothing there. No mill, no houses, a pile of sawdust, and that was all.
Well, what year were you born?
1925.
Okay.
July 12th.
Well, so you grew up.
The first things I remember were at Orangeburg, South Carolina, which is a relatively large town so far as South Carolina is concerned. Not
mm-hmm.
as big as Columbia, but...
Mm-hmm.
But then it wasn't tremendously large, but it had nice schools,
mm-hmm.
and I went to the first grade there.
Mm-hmm.
And
what do you remember about it?
Well, we lived on a street called Henley Street, and we lived in a nice house, but a middle-class house, not a...
Yeah.
And the school was a walking distance, right, straight down about, quarter of a mile or something. My sister, I had an older sister, 4 years older
mm-hmm.
than I. And she was also born at that sawmill place.
Yes.
And the nearest place to where we were born was Embry, a little tiny community called Embry,
uh-huh.
E-M-B-R-E-E.
Uh-huh.
But it wasn't anything much at all.
Did you ever hear stories about if you were attended when your mother was birthing you? Do you know if it was?
I understand a doctor came.
A doctor came
to the house.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
As a matter of fact, yes, I'm pretty sure a doctor was there.
And do you think your sister too maybe had a?
I might. Well, probably.
Probably.
Probably. And my sister, apparently they had a bed in one of the living rooms, and my sister was peeping in when I was born,
oh.
And my father discovered her and patted her a little bit.
Well, there was all this activity.
Yes.
Something was going on.
Yes.
Oh, that's something.
Yeah. And
well, now you went to first grade there.
At Orangeburg.
At Orangeburg. And do you remember anything about school? Or
Oh,
just
yes.
do you?
Yes. For one thing, they taught us to write immediately. They taught us to write in script.
I'll be darned.
We started in September. We had, as a matter of fact, they had a book that we kept. This is my storybook. And we had our first letters. We had our letter to Santa Claus and so on like that.
Oh, perfect.
One of my children still has this book, and it's
Excellent.
all the way through school. And my teacher was Miss Riley.
Oh, you remember it a lot.
Yeah. And so school was very easy for me. I was an all A type student at that age. And the school was a two-story brick building, a nice school building. And it was walking distance, the family was my older sister, 4 years older than my
Yes, and
husband,
what was her name? Mary.
Mary Elizabeth.
All right.
And also in the family, my father had been married previously, and they had three children. And then his wife died. And my mother, and he was at a sawmill down in South Georgia at that time. And my mother and her sister had helped care for this woman who was ill.
I see.
And she died. And that's how my father got to know my mother.
Yes.
And I don't have any information really. They never told me anything about how they really got together, but they obviously did.
Yes.
So I had three half siblings. And when we were at Orangeburg, the oldest of the three was a half sister, and she was off at college. They were that much older.
Sure.
And she was at Coker College in South Carolina, a very nice college for women. The only person that my family ever sent to college was this daughter.
Yes.
And she was called Mai. Her name was Marva Lee. Everybody called her Mai, and I called her Mai. Also, when I was born, she wanted me to be named Jimmy. But then anyway, but she all my life called me Jimmy.
That's what she wanted. Aren't those family stories just
Yes,
something?
yes. And so she finished college and went to Charleston, got a job teaching, and met a fellow named Dermy Hughes, and they were married and lived there all their lives, had several children. The other two was Luther. My father's name was Luther Clarence Kazan. The second child from the first marriage was Luther Clarence Kazan Jr., who was always called Buck by everyone.
Buck.
Buck. He was an exceptional person, and when he was a teenager when we were at Orangeburg, and while he was still in high school, he got a job keeping books for the lumber company that was there. And when he was 16 years old, he got married. He married an 18-year-old girl whom they had a family over long years and years. And he got a job with the post office, and the United States Post Office, stayed with it all his life.
All his life.
And he ended up as a postmaster in Columbia.
I'll be darned. That's wonderful.
I don't know whether he ever even finished high school. He might have. The third person of them was Roddy Roberts Kazan. And I believe that the first wife was a Roberts.
I see.
I'm not sure about
that. Yeah.
And Roddy was an athlete.
Okay.
He was a boxer. He played football.
Uh-huh.
He played all sports.
Uh-huh.
And so...
How many years older was he than you?
The youngest one was 10 years older than I was.
I got you. Okay.
So I was 66 years. He was 16.
Mm-hmm.
They
were almost aunts and uncles.
In a way.
Mm-hmm.
Roddy was a good athlete, and he got a scholarship to Clemson University.
Oh, my goodness.
Clemson College it was. Then.
Yes.
It was a military college then.
Mm-hmm.
So, and it just happened that the mill in Orangeburg burned on the summer after I was seven, I guess, maybe by that time, before I was seven. And the Depression was on, and there were no jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so the older daughter was a teacher.
Yeah.
And she was okay. Buck was with the post office, and he was secure.
Mm-hmm.
My brother Roddy got the scholarship to play football at Clemson, football and boxing and track.
Yes.
And so he went to Clemson College then.
Mm-hmm.
And we never got to see him do any of his sports. The Depression was so bad, my father could not get a job.
Yeah.
These companies that he worked for provided him with an automobile, usually a Buick, big Buick, for some reason. And but while we were there in Orangeburg, he bought my mother a car, Pontiac. So when the mill burned, he lost the Buick.
Mm-hmm.
The whole corporation was gone, and no jobs were available. And so my mother's sister, who had actually helped to take care of this first wife of
mm-hmm.
my father's,
mm-hmm.
Lived at Hilliard, Florida, on a farm with her husband. They invited us to come down and stay with them until my father could get a job.
Mm-hmm.
So we moved down with all of our furniture and all to Hilliard, and the furniture was stored in a shed at the farm.
Mm-hmm.
And my father went off in the car that he bought for my mother.
Mm-hmm.
Was gone for over a year. We never got any money from him. He didn't make enough money to just get along. So he finally came back on a bus. Car was gone.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very independent type. He didn't want to get anything from the government, but he ended up working for the WPA
mm-hmm.
for a dollar a day. And during this year or year and a half that we lived with the Davises mm-hmm. on this subsistence farm,
mm-hmm.
we worked on the farm with them. They had cows, they had pigs, and they had fruit trees, oranges.
So how old were you then?
Well, I was probably seven by the time we went down
seven
there.
Seven or eight, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Seven and eight.
And do you remember that as a...
Oh, like yesterday.
Do you remember it as a happy time or difficult?
Was for me.
Yes.
It was happy for me. I liked it there.
Yes.
My sister didn't like it particularly.
Uh-huh.
But it was a very country little place.
Yes.
The little town of Hilliard was.
Uh-huh.
But they had a nice school. It was a two-story brick building school, strangely enough.
Mm-hmm.
And so the school seemed fine,
mm-hmm.
and we went on a school bus.
Mm-hmm.
When my father came back, we moved to a little tiny house, unpainted shack of a house,
mm-hmm.
about a mile out from Hilliard, but we moved out from where the uncle's house.
Yeah.
And my father had this job of $1 a day,
mm-hmm.
but we lived next next door to about 100 yards from the Gordons, who was a rural mail carrier. Mm-hmm. And he owned the house, rented it for nothing practically, I guess, to us. Mm-hmm. And also loaned us a cow. He had two cows, gave us the better.
Isn't that something? Those are the stories I've heard. Everybody helped everybody.
I'm sorry about getting emotional.
Well, you've got the right person as far as that's concerned. Because, I'm more emotional every year. I just a pretty song or a gorgeous bird will just trip me off.
Yeah. Well, so we lived in this little house next to the gardens. We went to school on a little school bus that was sort of a made up school bus. It was a truck.
But it was transportation.
Yeah, it was fine. And I enjoyed living there. It was in the woods. Mm-hmm. Right behind the house was forest. And they even had panthers, Florida panthers in the
forest. My goodness.
I had heard them, but I haven't ever seen one of them. A little creek where you could actually swim.
Sounds like heaven for a little 8-year-old boy.
Not bad. It was.
Yeah.
And I went to school there, and I sold clovering salve to all the people who walked all around the countryside, and I'd sell clovering salve for 25 cents, and surprisingly enough, a lot of people bought it.
Uh-huh.
I think just donating to us.
Whatever.
And I got a watch. I got a watch for selling the clovering salve.
Did you?
Mm-hmm. And then after a couple of years, my father got a job.
Uh-huh. As what?
Same thing that he'd always done.
Ah.
At another, it was a lumber company in Columbia, South Carolina.
Ah.
And I guess I was 10 then, maybe.
Uh-huh.
And he had to go and... he had to go in before we did. As a matter of fact, my mother was pregnant because my younger brother was born before we moved the family.
I see.
And I gave my father the watch.
Yes.
And then we went to Columbia, or Casey, just outside of Columbia, a little town.
Mm-hmm.
And my father worked for a lumber company there. But we only lived there about a year.
Do you remember anything when you were in South Carolina about, did you have any contact with African Americans, or do you have...
None.
You certainly didn't have any in the schools.
Only the workers. My father frequently took workers. He had this big Buick. It seems that they always gave him a Buick. Why, I don't know. But anyway... he would sometimes take workers out to the woods.
Sure. What kind of a man was your father?
He was stern. He told me bedtime stories, usually Bible stories.
I see.
He, our family, there was no cursing, no smoking, no alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
It was strictly up and up. It didn't seem to me that it was exceedingly religious, but...
did you go to church?
Yes, Baptist.
Baptist church?
Mm-hmm. Went to Baptist church in Orangeburg.
Just on Sundays or other times too?
I don't remember anything other than just Sundays.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. But you certainly, led a...
And... we went to church wherever we were, so in Casey, near Columbia.
Yes.
And I was, as a matter of fact, at Hilliard, when we were down at Hilliard, we went to a little Baptist church. And that Baptist church had a piano, but nobody could play it. But my sister, she was 11 then, I guess.
Uh-huh.
She played by ear. and she played the piano for me.
She just sat down and it turned out to be her job.
When they sang, she played.
Isn't that wonderful? Well, that was meant to be.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, also when I was 8, the preacher always invited people to come join the church.
Yeah.
And I hadn't discussed this with anybody, but I went down and joined the church. And then they had a special ceremony for me, and I was baptized in the St. Mary's River.
Really?
Yes. So that's...
Now tell me about your mother.
My mother was born on grew up on a farm on the Suwannee River in South Georgia.
Mm-hmm. What kind of a person was she? What kind of...
She was a very sweet person.
Mm-hmm.
I was probably her favorite. She did all kind of special things for me, food-wise and everything. And she made clothes for us. She sewed, but we had very elegant clothes.
Yeah.
Which was laughed at when we came down to Hilliard.
Yeah.
And so she was a very sweet person. And the older children called her Mama, and she treated them just like she treated us.
Sure.
And they all loved her. And her life ended as a tragedy, but it's a long story.
What happened?
We're running up to World War II now.
Well, shall we save that for a little bit?
Yeah, I think so.
All right. We'll keep going on chronologically. You're doing a good job. This is going to be one of my easy ones.
Let's see.
Okay, so you're about 10
Casey,
years old. And yes.
Yeah, at Casey.
We kind of got off the track.
Then my father got a better job at Waynesboro, Georgia.
Oh, yes.
And Waynesboro was a lovely little town, still is.
Uh-huh.
And it was just wonderful. We lived at a house across from a park. And it was just a simple house, but still there.
Mm-hmm.
Across from a park. And it was, everybody was friendly. And I loved it. And
mm-hmm.
My sister also, as a matter of fact, she married a man from there. One of the old families.
Uh-huh.
And we were there 3 or 4 years, I guess, or something.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, I was in the 8th grade there, and I was the only 8th grader on the high school football team. I weighed 120 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
And I was a guard. And I just got beat up all the time. But I was fast. That's why I was the only 8th grader on the team. And then, there are a lot of wonderful things about Waynesboro. And one was that my sister, 4 years older than I was, met a man who was one of the oldest families around, on a plantation.
Mm-hmm.
And they later married. And that's a complicated thing, too, later on.
What else did you like in school besides football?
Well, at Waynesboro, they taught Latin, for one thing. I didn't like Latin.
Mm-hmm.
But everything else I liked.
Mm-hmm.
And
you were still getting good grades, or?
Yes, as I always got good grades.
Mm-hmm.
And my brother, who was at Clemson, bought me a bicycle for one of the Christmases.
How nice.
Yes, so that was wonderful. And I also sold parched peanuts on Saturdays.
Oh.
I'd go all over town. And
so you were still doing the entrepreneur thing, weren't you?
Mm-hmm. And my mother would be sure they were parched just right and so on.
That's wonderful.
And I also carried a newspaper when I got the bike.
Oh, sure.
I delivered a paper, the Savannah Morning News.
Yeah.
And I recall one time I went to a place where I took the paper, and it was time to collect.
Yeah.
And I went and said to the man there, I said, oh, I would like to collect for the paper.
Yes.
And he said, well, go ahead. And I said, well, I've done my part. You have to do your part.
What did he say?
He said, you've done your part.
Uh-huh.
So that was just another.
Was it a morning paper or an evening?
Savannah Morning News, I believe.
Uh-huh. So you had to get up?
Yes.
Early.
That's right. They delivered it, dropped it off at a place before dawn.
And you had to fold it and...
Mm-hmm. Deliver it, mm-hmm. Right? I didn't have very many customers, but anyway, it was an income.
But that's a good start. Mm-hmm. A lot of people talk about that as...
Yeah. So that was a positive part about Waynesboro,
mm-hmm.
too.
Uh-huh.
And met some wonderful friends there.
And how long then were you in Waynesboro?
Probably, as I said, let's see, I was in eighth grade, so that was probably when I was 14 that we left there.
Okay.
And then my father got a job, which he considered a better job even, at a sawmill in a little town called Elizabethtown, North Carolina.
Mm-hmm.
And my father was very well acquainted, friendly, with a fellow named D.A. Gardner. And he worked, and D.A. Gardner owned the mill in Orangeburg that burned. I think he owned the mill in Columbia. And he had this mill up in Elizabethtown, North Carolina. Mm-hmm. And so he offered my father a job.
Mm-hmm.
And we went up there, and this was a tiny little town, 1,500 people. But we moved into a house that was just a gorgeous house. It was Greek style, mm-hmm. stucco,
mm-hmm.
up on a hill, out of town, about a half mile. Just a lovely place.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a whole big bedroom, bigger than this room.
Oh my goodness.
All to myself.
I'll be darned.
And it opened onto a patio,
mm-hmm.
That had a wall around it with an arch.
Oh, my goodness.
It was a wonderful house. And so we lived in there about a year.
And you went to school there?
Yes, at Elizabethtown.
But you didn't graduate from that high school. You did?
I did.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And what year was that?
1942.
Oh.
That's where World War II
began. Uh-huh. I was going to say, that's a very bad year.
And so this house came up for sale for $1,500. Things. My father did not have $1,500, and he would not borrow money. He would not borrow money. Oh, this D.A. Gardner had tried to get him to go in with him. Borrow $10,000 and go in with him, but he would not do that.
No.
So we poked around.
Yeah.
And so on the mill that D.A. Gardner had, in about a year, burned.
Mm-hmm.
Burned up. Gone.
Yeah.
I don't know whether he set those things afire or not, but it seemed to be.
Well, actually, you know, from an awful lot of the interviews I've done, that was not uncommon. I mean, all of that stuff was very, very volatile.
Mm-hmm.
And so...
Well, they used steam, and they made it with their slabs.
Yes, and it's all...
Yeah, it was...
All, you know,
and when
fuel.
And when they would burn, everything seemed to burn.
It just went up.
The equipment and saws and everything. So... Anyway, that burned up. But fortunately, there was another even bigger mill in Elizabethtown.
Oh.
And my father got a job with them right away.
Right away.
Mm-hmm. Doing the same thing.
Well, wonderful.
Mm-hmm. So we stayed there. We had to move out of this wonderful house, which was for sale. Mm-hmm. And we moved to a little brick house, which is also the second nicest house we ever lived in.
Well, you moved lots before you ever graduated from high school.
Oh, yes.
Do you think that taught you anything? I mean, going from different towns?
Probably.
What lessons do you think?
I don't know.
I always think of the flexibility and the adaptability that I think I learned from that mm-hmm. kind of experience, that people who were born, grew up, and stayed in the very same house, the very same neighbors, the very same community, didn't seem to have.
Mm-hmm.
That's just my hypothesis.
I haven't really thought about that particularly, but it probably did have a significant effect.
I mean, you learn new friends, mm-hmm. you mm-hmm. learn new games to play, or the same game with a different name.
Yes. When we got to Elizabethtown, this little town, my sister Mary had finished high school.
Uh-huh.
And she was just floundering around. And she went down to the bank, and they loaned her $100. And she took the money and went to Charleston and started secretarial school.
All right.
And she got a job before she finished that school. She never did finish the course, but she got the job.
Got the job.
And then the Evans boy from Waynesboro showed up.
Uh-huh.
And they started going together. And then he was up in Norfolk for some reason and got sick. She went up and nursed him back to health.
Uh-huh.
Then they got married in mm-hmm. Charleston.
Did she pay back the loan?
Of course.
Of course, her daddy would have taught her. Yep. I already knew the answer to that.
So she was... And then the Evans, my sister, and her husband moved back to Waynesboro, where she lived the rest of her life.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
A wonderful place. And she worked, she had a job at one of the federal agriculture agencies.
Uh-huh. And well, now, you graduated from high school.
In Elizabethtown.
In Elizabethtown. And
I also played football up there.
Uh-huh.
And... the football coach, the first year, I was just 14 then, I guess, and the football coach had to leave for some reason, and I told him my brother, Roddy, who was teaching at a little place in South Carolina, I told him that my brother was a coach and a teacher, and so the principal, I told him that the principal called him, and my brother came up, and the town... He was a charming person. Never met anyone he didn't like, and he played first string in the Clemson football team. He was a boxing champion of South Carolina.
Well, he was the new hero, wasn't he?
Mm-hmm. He did the broad jump.
Well, that was kind of nice. To recommend your brother.
He came up, and everybody liked him. The businessmen there chipped in to increase his salary from what the school allowed.
Oh, isn't that great?
And then they built him and his wife a little house. There was only one block of stores. Uh-huh. And right at the end of the block, they built this little house.
Oh, my gosh.
Fairy house.
Well, you know, it just seems like, you know, the kind of life that your father and mother lived, and your father didn't want to borrow money and those kinds of things, you know, that comes back to you, mm-hmm. you know, and all of these wonderful things that happened, you know, people remember good people.
Yeah.
I had a business colleague who was the CEO of the Hospital Corporation of America, and he said, good people beget good people. And so he would like, you know, responsible people that worked in his organization to recommend people that they thought were good.
Mm-hmm.
And that was good enough for him.
Yeah. Well, my little 10-year younger brother, Ben, was born in the house of the farmhouse at Hilliard.
Uh-huh.
After my father had gotten the job up in Columbia.
Yeah.
So he's a native Floridian.
Yes.
But anyway, he was in the family too. There, we were up at North Carolina. He was a little boy.
Yeah.
And in Waynesboro. So.
Well, what did you think you were going to do the day after graduation from high school?
Well, for one thing, in high school, football was a big thing. My brother was a coach.
Yes.
Just established, got everybody to.
He was be the supportive.
The town got football equipment for us, and we had a football team. And he tested everybody out individually. I was the second fastest person. The fastest was a big fella who was a tackle on the team, but I was agile, and I became the quarterback.
Wonderful,
my brother.
Wonderful.
I did the passing, the punting, and a lot of the running.
Uh-huh.
So I was the best player on the team. And it wasn't a big team, but anyway. But we did, my brother did get us a game with Orangeburg, that's a bigger town where we had originally lived.
Uh-huh.
And we lost 14-12.
Ooh.
But I played quarterback, and I punted, and I played linebacker on defense.
Oh, my goodness.
And I had a really good game that time, and somebody from Clemson. So.
Really?
So, my brother contacted them in my senior year, and they said, bring him on down.
Really?
So I went down and talked to the coach at Clemson.
Uh-huh.
And I was offered a scholarship there.
Uh-huh.
But then the war started. We had an attack on Pearl Harbor.
Yes.
And this was January, just before I was graduated. We only had 11 grades there.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And I was graduated a month before I was 17.
Uh-huh.
I was still 16. And let's see. For one thing, my father still didn't make a lot of money, and my mother and my father handled all the money. My mother had no money.
Mm-hmm.
She wasn't allowed to fiddle with the money.
Yeah.
It was one of those autocratic type of things.
Mm-hmm.
She was not abused at all.
But, no, but that was the roles.
Yes, and so. This was 42 then. It was December of 41 with Pearl Harbor. And then I remember when that happened. I heard it on the radio.
Were you at home?
Yes.
What was the reaction of everybody in the room?
All the boys were afraid they wouldn't get into the war before it was over. That's the way they felt.
Yep.
The girls didn't make any comments that I remember.
Remember anything Nobody from your mother?
Nobody was afraid. No, not my mother either. That I was about. And I was 17, and this Elizabethtown was 50 miles from Wilmington.
Uh huh.
50 miles up the Cape Fear River, and they had established a big shipyard there.
That's right.
Building Liberty ships.
Yes.
And I went down and got a job there as a shipfitter's helper.
Yep.
And worked about 6 months, roughly, there.
What was your job?
I was a shipfitter's helper, and the shipfitters, these Liberty ships were built in various stages, and it had a big yard where these huge plates of steel were bent and shaped, and then they were taken over to the way where the ship was put the keel down. The ship fitters had to get all these pieces lined up right and then tack weld them.
Okay.
And so I was taught, and all this was taught on the job.
Sure.
And so I was just helping to do what the ship fitter, and where they found all these people who knew how to build ships, I don't know, because they had about 7 or 8 ways going on all the time.
Yeah.
So it was welding, and then getting these plates together and until the ship was up, and they launched about a ship a week.
Did they really?
Yeah. Strangely enough, it was,
I've talked to some others that have worked.
Yeah.
And done that.
And they were beautiful ships to me. I thought they were just beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the Merchant Marine must have had some advertising about going into the Merchant Marine.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided I would like to do that. I was 17. I wasn't eligible for the draft yet for the military.
Mm-hmm.
So I volunteered for the Merchant Marine School up in Hoffman Island, New York.
Mm-hmm.
They sent me up there by train. I spent 3 months up there.
What did your parents think? Did they think that was a good idea?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So they were supportive.
Mm-hmm. And so that was the beginning of my war experience, at the shipyard and then the Merchant Marine.
And where was the training, did you say?
It was in Hoffman Island, New York, which was in New York Harbor.
Okay.
Hoffman Island is probably now one of the bases of one of those big bridges going over there.
Uh-huh.
I expect. But mm-hmm. It had about 2,000 or 3,000 people. I had one boxing match there, and I won.
Well, there was a lot of that informal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, certainly in the service, they talk about, you know. Okay, and so after your three-month training.
Well, they marched us down Wall Street, and we got our seaman's papers,
uh-huh.
and we had to join the Seaman's Union.
I see.
And then, and in this training, besides being trained on the island, we also were trained on ships. There was a big three-masted schooner, a sailing vessel, called the Bima. And we had to keep this spick and span and climb the mast and all that.
Uh-huh.
But we never did take it out. However, my little group that went there was considered one of the best, and they gave us a dance at the top of the New York Hotel.
Oh!
I'd never danced. At all.
Oh, well, now would your father have approved? Is dancing okay?
Probably not.
Uh huh. That was certainly borderline anyway.
Mm-hmm. And so there were young girls, well, there were girls there anyway.
Yeah.
And one of them came and asked me to dance. Oh, and in the Merchant Marine school, we had uniforms like sailors.
Yes.
They were dark, but they had red on them instead of white.
I see.
And we had sailor caps.
Uh-huh.
So we looked like sailors. I mean, that's
pretty sharp.
Yeah.
Pretty sharp.
Anyway, that was the dress uniform. Because we had dungarees and denim shirts most of the time.
Yeah.
So a girl asked me to dance, and I thought I didn't know how to dance. And she said, well, I'll teach you.
Uh-huh.
So we got out, and she taught me for a minute, and she said, let's sit this one out.
Was not one of your natural talents?
She said, there was not. Well, I guess if I had been taught.
Yeah.
I learned to dance later.
Sure.
One of the things she said was, she said, I don't drink and I don't smoke, but that doesn't mean I don't do other things.
Well, my goodness, that makes you pause for thought.
Yes. And I just passed that over.
I think that was very wise.
And I had a girlfriend at Elizabethtown.
Mm-hmm.
And she probably liked me, but she didn't love me. And I really think that I loved her.
Mm-hmm.
And she was the daughter of the farm agent for the county.
Uh-huh.
And they lived way out of town. And so I had a little bit of time with her, dates with her while in high school.
Yeah.
But not much. And also, as soon as we were graduated, she went off to college.
Mm-hmm.
And like a lot of the other... So I was in the Merchant Marine, and I had two ships. The first ship I was on was a coal ship, Collier, and it was being loaded with cold in Norfolk, and they sent us down by train and dumped us off at the Seamen's Union assigned ships to us.
I see.
So I got this ship, which was called can't think of the name. It was I'll think of it later.
Yeah.
It was just a little black ship, small, but full of coal. And they were dumping the last coal cars in. And I got a little bit seasick looking at it rising. So I went up and put my sea bag. I got on the ship, and they were trying to get it cleaned up after the last coal was dumped in. And I started trying to help. They said, go down and get your work clothes on. But as a matter of fact, by the time I got back from the work clothes, they had it all hosed off, and we were ready to go to sea. And then the ship was a terrible looking little ship, but the wheelhouse was beautiful.
Oh, really?
Yes, it was glass, and it was a beautiful wheel. And
I'll be darned.
Yeah.
How large was the crew?
Not very large. I don't know how many, probably eight, something like that. It had a couple of guns on it, cannon, that Navy sailors were
responsible for. Well, what was your job?
Well, my job was just working. We had watch, and there were no lights at night.
Oh, right.
All out. And they had a watch at the bow and a watch at the top and a watch at the stern. And if you saw something like a light or anything, you'd call out, white light, 2 points off the port bow. And the officer would say, I see it.
Yeah.
Really, just voice. And the captain, in my first watch on the bow, captain came down and put his hand on my shoulder and said, son, if you got a puke, go to Lourdes.
Well, now, the ship was to take the coal where?
To Boston.
To Boston. Okay.
So we were going up the coast, within sight of the coast in the daytime.
Yeah.
And I was on wheel. One thing that happened, I was on wheel watch, and the compass, not in numbers, but in the old west by north and things like that.
Yeah.
And so we had a heading to keep the ship on. And the third mate, who was an Englishman, was with me in the wheelhouse when I was on my first time on the wheel. And there was a night. And the ship kept drifting toward the shore. I'd turn the wheel and bring it back, and it would drift more. And finally, I had it at full right rudder, and it started drifting away again. And I called the third mate who was there, and I said, listen, told him what was going on.
Yeah.
And he took it and said, sure enough, so he ran down and got the captain. The captain came up, and he took the thing and whirled it one way and whirled it another and whirled it another way, and then it got it straightened out. He said, the rudder is run by steam, and it leaks off a little bit. You have to sort of let it balance itself.
I see.
You don't just hold it one way.
So it was losing a little.
Yeah.
I'll be
so gone. Then it worked fine. But we were going through the Cape Cod Canal, and he took over voice, and I was on the wheel. He took over voice control, and he said, hard right rudder. And I got to think, about the steam. And he blew a stack.
Oh, really?
And when I'm on control, you just do exactly what I say, and so on. So I did. And we didn't run into the side of the So we went to Boston, and all the crew, all the officers, the crew, and everybody except the cook and I volunteered. I'd get double time money for staying and watch on the ship. They didn't tell me that it had about a 20-foot tidal range. And so I was just watching the ship, and the hawsers lined about this big around.
Yeah.
They got tighter and tighter, and the cook said, those lines are getting pretty tight. I said, yeah, golly. And he said, I'll help you loosen them up. So he did. The cook helped me. But they didn't say anything to me about this. Anything. So the cook saved a disaster.
Yeah.
They probably would have broken the lines.
Yeah.
We would have been adrift. So that was another little thing. And
that's how you learn, I guess. And it doesn't matter who tells you.
And I went ashore for about 30 minutes on Scully Square in Boston. And
did you?
Saw the sailors and the girls and the little shops and all.
Uh-huh.
And came back. And then we started back. So got the coal all out.
Uh-huh.
Pretty soon. And started back. And we were just out of Boston a little bit. And the ship started keeling to one side. And the first mate said, we've got a stopped-up pump down in the hole. I want a volunteer to go down with me to unstop the pump. So we went down in this black, waist, chest-deep water and got the pump unstopped. And came back up, and I don't even think that the first mate even said thank you or anything like that. It was just part of the job. But anyway, it straightened out after we got it pumped out.
Mm.
And so then that went on back, and there were no other incidents on that trip. It was a 9-day trip.
I see.
And back at the Seamen's Union.
Then they give you another assignment?
Yes. And they said, how much sea time do you have? And I said, 9 days. All the other seamen, they said, old salt.
That's right. You're a pro now.
And so they assigned me to a Liberty ship.
Ah.
Thomas Nelson Page.
Uh-huh.
And so that was what I was looking for. Oh, and the captain called me and asked me to stay aboard the Middlesex is what it was.
Okay.
SS Middlesex. Captain called me down and asked me to stay aboard the Middlesex. And I told him I wanted to go deep sea. He said, I understand.
Uh-huh.
But anyway, they realized I was trying.
Yeah.
So, and also, also when I got back from the second trip in Thomas Nelson Page, I read a little squib in the Elizabethtown newspaper that the SS Middlesex had sunk off one of the capes.
No.
In a storm.
No.
Really.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah. Whew. It didn't say anything about whether people were lost or what, but that just
that was enough.
Mm-hmm. So the Thomas Nelson Page.
You got on that.
And it joined about 60 other ships at Hampton Roads, Virginia.
Uh-huh.
And then we took off to the southeast and went through all the seaweed what do they call that? Oh, heavens, I'm not thinking very good. Anyway, they were flying fish. I was just thrilled.
I'll bet. Now that's way out.
That was 2 or 3 days getting there down to just off the east of the Bahamas.
Uh-huh.
And all the seaweed and the flying fish. And then
now this was a much larger ship, isn't that right?
Yes, it was about 10,000 tons.
And so you had a larger crew.
And it had a load of flour.
I gotcha, okay.
A load of flour, and it had some big cylinders welded on the deck that said had poison gas.
Okay.
And so we, then as soon as we got out of this out into the ocean much. We started having night attacks by submarines every night. And the 60 ships, approximately 60, were convoyed by destroyer escorts. Mm-hmm. They had built a smaller, fast destroyer with depth charges and stuff. And so it was, the depth charges were just going boom, 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 boom all the time.
All night.
And we lost two ships going across the Atlantic.
Really?
It took about a month. Yeah. We were going very slow, about 5 knots.
Uh-huh.
And hit the coast of Morocco.
Uh-huh.
And we were coming up the coast of Morocco very slow, and we got near the Straits of Gibraltar. And then whoever had the charge of the whole convoy gave the orders for everybody to go flank speed, fast as they would go. So that every ship cranked up. And we got through the Straits of Gibraltar just at dusk.
Uh-huh.
And then it got dark, and we were all out, spread out in the Mediterranean, and back behind us, flares started dropping.
Really?
Yes, they knew spies were in Spain and Morocco and would say how fast we were going and so on.
Sure.
And they, in charge, I mean, it was done perfectly. Nobody got hit by anything in there.
But you knew the danger was out there.
Well, yeah, they were going to bomb us. And so the convoy cruised along the North African coast. And
yeah.
We stopped at Bizerte, which was in Tunisia.
Uh-huh.
And then went to Naples, Italy.
I see.
And we lost a ship. It was torpedoed just as we went by Sicily.
But if you were all in convoy, you could see all that, couldn't you?
Most of the 60 ships were spread out pretty
spread
far.
Spread out, okay.
And so we went on into the Bay of Naples, which is gorgeous. And the volcanoes were all the, mm-hmm. There was one called Stromboli on an island just off Sicily.
Mm-hmm.
On Sicily itself, Mount Etna. But,
yes.
And then Vesuvius, of course, at Naples.
Yeah.
So we went into Naples, and all the wharfs were blocked by sunken German and Italian ships.
Really?
So we tied up to a German liner that was on the bottom. And they just put planks across them and did
oh
the
my gosh.
There. But they came to our captain and told him that our cargo was not a priority and they needed another ship in there. And so we went back out and anchored in the middle of Naples Harbor.
Uh-huh.
And that night, and every night, German planes came over and bombed. And that ship that took our place was hit, and it was full of
explosions,
and it just went a big fireball.
Do you know, the stories I hear, though, are time and time again of, you know, the reason you're sitting here is because you got missed that time,
yeah,
and somebody lucky. Else got
yeah.
it, and that's invariably, you know,
yeah.
what people's stories are about.
Yeah.
You know, they take a chance and say, I'm going there, and something happened here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the Liberty ships had a 5-inch cannon
uh-huh.
aft and a 3-inch cannon forward,
uh-huh.
and these were manned by Navy
yeah.
crews. They had 4 20-millimeter anti-aircraft guns,
uh-huh.
and they were by the Merchant Marine crew. I was on a 20-millimeter,
uh-huh.
the Orlikon, made in Sweden,
uh-huh.
and they were dangerous. They had 20 millimeters, but about this long, and they had the explosives in the nose. And they told us that even a raindrop had been known to explode those things, so don't drop them. So we'd have whole banks or belts of these things, and we just had to be very careful with those.
Yeah.
But anyway, and every time something happened, we had to go up and get in the tank with the anti-aircraft guns, just in case we were attacked.
And that was pretty often?
Well, we never were directly attacked.
But you had to go up there from time to time.
Yeah, we'd have to go up. Even when even when they were bombing in Naples, and they bombed every night. They didn't bomb in the daytime at all, just at night. And the Army anti-aircraft was so much that it was like the 4th of July. Just one tracer out of every third. But it was just like, it would just light up the sky.
Yeah.
And these big searchlights would show the planes.
Yeah, yeah.
But we didn't ever get hit.
And were you frightened?
No, not a bit. Just watching a movie.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, I never saw but one person who was frightened.
Really?
Mm-hmm. When they finally got us unloaded. Oh, and by the way, we were allowed to go ashore.
I was going to ask about that.
Yeah, we were allowed to go ashore, which we did, and forgotten what kind of boats we had, whether... I really have forgotten just
some
how
kind
we went
of
ashore.
Shore launch or something, yeah.
One of our, yeah, I think from our ship.
Uh-huh.
And so I got to see Pompeii. Oh, and all the money was cigarettes. No, Italian money was no good. U.S. money was no good. Cigarettes.
Cigarettes.
And we were allowed to buy one carton of cigarettes a week from the ship store.
And you didn't use very many of those.
I didn't use any. I never smoked. As a matter of fact, I don't remember seeing anybody smoke one.
Really?
I wondered who smoked them, because if we went in and got a haircut, it was a pack of cigarettes. If we'd have a taxi out to Pompeii, it was a pack of cigarettes.
Isn't that something?
Yeah. And
that was the currency.
Who smoked them? I don't know.
I would think that, you know, sailors, you know, would have been, but apparently not.
Yes, actually, even the soldiers' daily food would have cigarettes in it.
Really?
You know, like a 6 or 8 or
yeah,
something like
yeah.
that. Yeah. So they expected everybody to be smoking, and I guess they sort of encouraged it in a way.
It was, yeah.
Yeah, everybody smoked, but not me.
No.
And so then.
So did you ever unload?
They finally sent some barges out with black stevedores, black soldiers, and unloaded all this flour. And the flour was in bags, and took off the poison gas from the decks.
Yeah, the canisters.
And then we left Naples and went to Oran, Algeria, North Africa.
Exotic.
Yeah.
Never heard about that in South Carolina, did you?
No. And Oran was a very interesting place.
How do you spell Oran?
O-R-A-N.
All right.
It was a big port,
Uh-huh.
And we went in, and there was a French warship lying up at one of the wharfs, and a battleship, actually, of the Free French. And the town of Oran had streets that were for pedestrians, had steps on them even. There were a few for cars, but most of them were for pedestrians.
Really?
And so I and some of the other sailors from the Thomas Nelson Page, we weren't told exactly what we were going to be doing there, but we were allowed to go ashore. And a little French boy, a little boy who spoke French and English, he was about 7 or 8 years old. He volunteered to be our
guide,
and he guided us around town and showed us everything. And and we went to we went in a bar, and I was with about 3 others. Oh, and a French foreign legionnaire joined us.
Oh.
And he had the most faded uniform. It was a typical legionnaire's uniform, but it was so faded, it was almost like that.
I'll be darned.
Yeah, he had just been in the desert a long time.
That's how it gets that way.
So he just hung around with us, and the little French-speaking boys talked to him, and he would talk to us in English. And And it was really interesting.
I bet.
And we went to a movie that was nothing. And we went to the bar. The little boy couldn't go in the bar. He had to wait outside. And they went in and I didn't drink. So they got me some kind of soda or something. Uh-huh. And so then we found out they were making a troop ship out of our ship. They were putting bunks in it.
Oh.
And sure enough, it took several weeks, actually, to get all these things put in. And then a contingent of American soldiers from North Africa got on our ship, and we took them to Naples. And the only person I saw on this whole trip who was afraid was one of these soldiers.
Is that right?
Yes, we were in a convoy. We waited until a convoy came along. We joined the convoy. And right beside us, a ship was torpedoed. A munition ship went up in a big fireball. And the crew, of course, had to get on their our tubs with their anti-aircraft and so on. And I was going up, putting on a helmet and a life jacket, and this one soldier was like that. His eyes were just so wide, and he was just terrified. And I said, "Take it easy, it'll be all right." He said, "You get up there where you belong." And all the other soldiers were like watching a movie.
Yeah.
We were all just, it was not one person showed any fear of any, not any time while I was on this trip. So we took the Americans back to Naples.
Yes.
Got them off. The front was about 20 miles from Naples. You could hear the guns exploding off
of
the
really?
Front. Vesuvius was erupting and running down. Really exotic. And there was a lot of waiting around, and finally we were sent back to Iran. And we got a shipload of French Arab soldiers. They had long rifles with bayonets about that long, and they had a loaf of bread stuck on each bayonet. They also had barrels of cognac that put down in the hole. And one of them accidentally broke. And so the crew had buckets going down, and they all, we had our quarters, a little room with two double bunks, so four of us. And one was a youngster from North Carolina, about my age. Another was a 25-year-old fellow from Ohio. And the other was a black man from Philadelphia, the only black on the ship. And so they all drank except for me, and they took this cognac and lit it and let it get flame up, and then they dip in and get it. So it looked pretty exotic, but I didn't drink. I was a Bible-carrying Baptist.
Did you catch any razz for that, or
well,
did
as
they?
As a matter of fact, the Ohio man one time said, "You really believe that Jesus didn't have a father?" And I said, "Oh yes, Joseph was his father." Showed you how deep my. Anyway, he just shook his head. And so, and I read the Bible. So it's just something in the Bible every day.
Yeah. And well, how did the four of you get along?
Well, we got along fine. The boatswain came to me the first day and asked me if I wanted to move, knowing I was from the South and the black man. I said, "No, I don't want to move. I didn't want to do that." And it turned out that the only one I remember the name of it on that ship is A.B. Hawkins, the black man. He was about 45 years old, and on Christmas time, he said that was the first Christmas he'd spent out of jail in 20 years.
Is that right?
That's what he said. And he was a cook. And the others, a lot of them were prejudiced against him.
I would imagine.
Not just Southerners, as much as others.
Really?
Strangely enough.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, now, did you have, what was your rank?
I was called an ordinary seaman.
I could?
Ordinary seaman.
Okay.
And if you'd had some time at sea and so on, you could get to be an able-bodied seaman. Those were what the...
Well, what it was
and
called.
And after that, you were either a boatswain, they call it bosun.
Uh-huh.
And, but he would be in charge of all the sailors.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So...
I've seen the terms, but I didn't know how they ranked and that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I was an ordinary seaman.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And most... All the other two in the... other than the cook, ordinary seamen also. Most of us on this ship had not really been to sea before.
Sure.
Most of us.
Sure.
But they had some very experienced people on there. The bosun was, he was a European, Norwegian or something like that. Spoke a heavy English accent. But he was excellent. He just knew exactly what to do with us and taught us. And what we did still was to stay on watch. We had these big masts with a lookout thing on top.
Yeah.
And also areas where the guns were and so on, where we'd have lookouts.
Mm-hmm.
And then the wheel watch. And I think we had... 2 hours on the watch, 2 hours on the wheel, 2 hours on watch, 2 hours on the wheel, and 4 hours off or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was set up, it was busy but comfortable.
Mm-hmm. And this would have been in all of the ports or even at sea?
Oh, at sea, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And yeah. So when you...
The search, the lookouts, of course, were only at sea.
Mm-hmm.
We were in... They didn't have a look at. There was somebody to stay with the ship. They wouldn't let the ship be abandoned. But but generally, we were allowed to go ashore. As a matter of fact, I went by myself and walked maybe a mile or two down to the Mediterranean coast because the inlet into Oran was pretty long, a mile or two. So I walked down the coast and along the.
Yeah.
It was pretty exotic.
I bet. You have pictures in your mind.
Mm-hmm. Nobody had a camera. There was not a camera aboard. Not allowed, I don't think.
That's right.
We didn't have any mail.
I was going to ask you if you kept in touch with home.
No, there was no mail, no place to send. The military had the, I've forgotten what they call it, but anyway, it was a military mail service.
Yes.
But we didn't have that. We didn't have any kind of contact.
Mm-hmm.
And... So we were sent to Naples and then with the French Algerian soldiers, and they were finally unloaded. Then we were sent back to Oran, picked up a load of German prisoners.
Mm-hmm.
The German prisoners were all so happy to be out of Africa. They were glad to be aboard Thomas Nelson Page. They wanted to help on the deck. They wanted to be out on deck all the time. But their officers, who were kept up on the with our officers and the ship's upper part of the ship. They were just so haughty, and one time the captain made them come out and see these, well, probably this convoy of maybe 100 ships, all as far as you could see everywhere. And they just turned their face away from it, wouldn't look at it. But I remember looking up and seeing that occur. So.
Well, what? Did you get a sense of why they wanted to get out of Africa? Was it the prison condition? Oh,
they were prisoners.
They were prisoners.
And they had had a rough time, probably.
And it had been hard
even
battle.
Before they were prisoners.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
so they were glad to leave that.
Yes, I think so.
Yeah.
And they were all very friendly.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. You know, you didn't get the impression that they were anything but the young guys, the same as you.
Officers were very haughty.
But yes.
The soldiers were just very friendly and wanted to help. They wanted to help do the jobs.
Yeah.
We let them do some things that we could show them.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
And then you took them where?
To Naples.
To Naples.
And why they must have had a prison camp there somewhere. I never found out why the prisoners were sent to Naples.
Now, I know there were some ships that brought them to prisons in the U.S.
Yes. As a matter of fact.
And crossed the Atlantic.
Yes. Yeah. German prisoners worked for these mills that my father.
Oh, really?
For the mill that my father. They worked out in the woods. And
yeah.
They're all over the U.S. I understand in the West and everywhere.
I think I've heard that too.
Mm-hmm. And I think they all enjoyed doing it.
Yes. Yes. And probably was not dissimilar to what they would have done as young men in their country.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So it was interesting that I guess they were loyal to their homeland and
sure.
Hitler and all, but they probably were beginning to sense it. As a matter of fact, Rommel,
yeah.
who was the commander of mm-hmm. Germans, and you know that he was part of the plot to kill Hitler, and that he was mm-hmm. assassinated for that.
Mm-hmm.
He and Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was a
yes.
philosopher.
Yes.
So Hitler was a real horror story. Anyway, that was
so
all
you...
of this took about 8 or 9 months, and
okay.
another month coming home, and the Thomas Nelson Page was empty coming home, riding high,
uh-huh.
and had no incidents. I don't.
So when did you come home?
In May of 44.
Okay. So you were in the Merchant Marines quite a while.
Yes, a little over a year. It was 43 and 44.
I gotcha. Okay.
Maybe it might have still been some 42 when I was first
mm-hmm.
into school
mm-hmm.
or something. But mm-hmm. anyway. And we were paid off, made $1,500 for that trip. That were paid off, and the ship was run by the Grace Lines.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. So the Grace Lines paid us off.
And
they got the I guess they got all of the crew together with the Seamen's Union.
Yes.
And they had the officers and
uh-huh.
so on. So.
And so they left you at what port?
We came into New York and tied up somewhere in New Jersey. I've forgotten exactly.
Mm-hmm.
And paid us off, and we got on a train and went to North Carolina.
And so when you got home, were you?
The family didn't know we were coming, that I was coming home. And they were glad to see me.
I bet you.
There were none of the friends were there. At all.
Yes.
And I was also 18. I was eligible for the draft. And I went to the draft board there in town.
Mm-hmm.
And I decided I would join the military and that I wanted to go in the Marine Corps. And so I did.
Okay.
So they sent me right up to Raleigh and on a bus. They did the physical there in Raleigh,
mm-hmm.
and the same afternoon I was in Parris Island.
Boy, what happened to the 2 weeks to say goodbye to the family? I guess they skipped that part for you.
It was just about a week that I was home.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, and when I first got home, we got a telegram, I think, from the bursar from the ship.
Yeah.
And said he had overpaid everybody by $50, and but that the Grace Line had not paid us for. The union had an agreement for these that every sailor would get $300 for if there was an attack on the air raid or any kind of attack on the first day in a port. And so we were in three different times that happened. because there was an air raid every night. So yeah. The first day we were supposed to get $300 from him. So he said if he would see about getting them to send that money down, and could he take the $50 out of it and so on. So actually, I just went to a lawyer. I didn't know any lawyer, but went to one there in Elizabethtown and told him that if he could, that I would agree to all that if he could arrange it. So he did, and so they sent extra money down.
Yeah.
Almost as much as he made.
Gosh. Yeah. So what did you think of Paris Island?
I loved it.
Did you?
Yeah.
It was athletic and physical and...
A lot of discipline.
A lot of
activity. You didn't walk anywhere. You ran. And I loved it.
That's wonderful. Made the right choice.
Yes. And then they tested us when we finished. They finished all of our... There were 13 weeks, actually, that we were trained in Paris Island. On the rifle range, I shot expert. That was a big thing in the Marine Corps.
Yes.
And then they tested us, gave us all kind of exams and stuff after we finished our training. I had requested to go into the artillery.
Mm-hmm.
They sent me to Cherry Point, the aviation station, because of my abilities, I guess.
Yes.
And so when they interviewed me at Cherry Point, they said, a corporal interviewed me. He said, I see that you have asked for the artillery. He said, the Marine Corps is putting 75 millimeter cannons in these PBJs, which are the B-25 medium bomber. He said, if you go to navigation school, you can be a navigator cannoneer. I said, suits me.
You're the dream of the of the recruiter, aren't you?
So I went to navigation school, and it was it didn't look like much, just little huts and then one of these big domes, but it was very sophisticated.
Yes.
And we were taught celestial navigation.
Wonderful.
And we had this dome where we had to learn to fly the links.
Yeah.
So that we could also fly the link trainer in the navigation dome.
Mm-hmm.
You could set the dome, the stars, for any time in the past or in the future even, or the present day.
Wow.
And we had all the... materials that we needed to work out
star positions,
fixes. Mm-hmm. So one would have to fly it to keep it on a certain track, and the other would do the shots and work out the fixes here and there and there and there. So it took several months.
I was going to ask you how long that training took.
It took several months, and by the time we finished the first airplane that I navigated, they designated me to be the first navigator. We had several navigator students.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
And we had gone to the weather shack and gotten the wind, where the wind was coming from and so on. But I looked up. The clouds are going different.
Mm.
So I put that down on my pad, and I checked where it was coming from, and I estimated the time. So we took off heading for some city in the Midwest, and I realized that we had a drift meter. You could read the drift corresponded to what I had seen out there, so I just put that down as this wind, and we went right into that town perfectly. And the other navigators wanted to say, where'd you get your wind from?
Yeah.
So I said, looking and watching the drift. So that was the first little incident.
But those are important observations.
Yeah. Yeah. And so by the time we finished the navigation, they'd found out that the cannons really didn't work very well.
Oh, really?
Tore up the planes or something.
Oh, gosh.
And so they sent me and the other groups of navigators to Bombardier School in California.
Uh-huh.
So there were several more months doing the...
Whereabouts in California?
El Centro, which is right down on the Mexican border.
Okay.
About 8 miles from Mexicali.
Okay.
There are two, Calexico and Mexicali, are two towns that are right, one on
either side of the border.
Yeah. And El Centro base was about 8 or 10 miles from there. Mm-hmm. So we went there several times out there. And the wind blew all the time. And the trainers that we had were little twin-engine Beechcraft, tail-down planes.
Mm-hmm.
But it had the Norden sight on it.
Oh.
This very sophisticated sight. And the Bombardier had to start the... This is the gyroscopic stabilized sight. And you'd have to get the gyroscope up to 10,000 revolutions per minute.
Uh-huh.
And then we could take off. We'd have it set. And then... we would get going toward the target, which was down in the Salton Sea. The pilot would say, the bombardier could take over. So we'd set the sights, and the Norden sight would fly the plane. You could see this view, and every time, keeping the sight within the Norden sight, mm-hmm. would fly the plane. It would tilt every little movement.
Isn't that amazing?
And it would release it when you were in the right trajectory, yes. and the right end. It was so sophisticated an instrument. It uh-huh. really was something. And so we learned to be a bombardier, and mm-hmm. and I also, after I finished, I was one of the instructors for a while.
Oh, how long did you do that?
Not long, just a week or two.
Mm-hmm.
And as a matter of fact, the one thing that was could be a tragedy was for the gyroscope to tilt. It could get going around and destroy the plane, actually.
Yeah.
So we were worried about that. But the first flight that I had as an instructor, the new navigator student was on, and he was set it for the target, and he looked around at me, wide eyed. The gyroscope was tilted over 45 degrees, so I told the pilot to take over the plane. So I went and eased it back up. Fortunately, it did ease back and set it. So then we started and flew it again. And that didn't happen again. But anyway, that happened. So there's always a little something to...
keep your attention, doesn't it? Well, then, now, how long then were you at Bombardier School? When did you...
I don't remember how long.
Okay. And then where did you...
Several months.
Okay. And so... And when you finished with that, and
I traveled down to Mexico, and I traveled to L.A.
Now, were you out of the Marines then?
Oh, no.
This was with the Marine Corps?
Yeah, just time off. I mean...
Oh, you mean leave. Okay.
Day or weekend leave or something.
Okay.
And so I got to see some of that. And
what was your next assignment?
Went back to Cherry Point, North Carolina.
Okay.
For operational training.
Okay.
And so we were in a group of these PBJs, the B-25 bomber. And we flew out, and there were targets set up on the offshore islands.
Yes.
So we would use these little 13-pound bombs, lead, and they would have a puff of smoke when it hit. So We were in training with that.
Mm-hmm.
And just operational training, waiting to be sent overseas to the Pacific. And,
yeah.
And then the bombs went off in Japan.
Uh-huh. What do you remember about learning about that?
Well, we learned that the war ended. It ended right away, within days.
How did you know? How did you hear? Who did you?
I've forgotten exactly how.
But you remember when? And
I guess we had radios, and so they grounded all of us.
And you and
we were grounded.
Your officers said, you know, the.
Oh, and
operation
cease. Out of navigation school and out of bombardier school, there's no ranking. I was a PFC.
Oh,
navigator,
really?
Bombardier. And,
really?
And so were the others. Whatever rank they went in, they came out. They had in the Army,
you would have
been a lieutenant.
Been promoted, yes.
Yeah, second lieutenant. But we were all
PFCs.
Just whatever, PFCs, or mm-hmm. there was a sergeant or two.
Mm-hmm.
And even there was an officer or two, I found out later. And in the Marine Corps, people under the rank of corporal have to spend a month in mess duty. And they pulled me off the flight line and others too,
yeah.
the bombardiers, and put us in the mess hall. So I made coffee for 10,000 men for a month.
Well, you got to put that somewhere on your Vita, don't you?
Yes.
Not everybody does that.
And I don't even like coffee. Still don't like coffee.
Well, that would do it.
Yes. On the ships, we had to make coffee when we were off. And it was on one of the ships was a big pot like this. And we just pour a pound of coffee in and fill it up with water, and that would put it on the stove, and that was it. They pour it out through a strainer.
Yep.
So anyway, I was grind up these 50-pound sacks of coffee beans, and it smelled so good. I'd put 25 pounds in each one of those big
vats,
makers, and that was all there was to that.
Yeah.
And,
that's a lot of coffee.
A lot of coffee, and it should have been fine, but a lot of people complained about it, of course. So anyway, while I was on mess duty, they sent down an order that all of navigators would be at least tech sergeants.
Ah.
So overnight, I became a tech sergeant, along with the other navigators.
Good.
The fellow in charge of the mess hall, the whole thing, which was a big mess hall, served 10,000 men. It was a staff sergeant, one below tech. And he didn't like the flyboys anyway, called them Airedales.
Well, this probably couldn't have helped.
So we decided we'd just stay on the mess duty till the end of the month. It was about a week.
Yeah.
So we, oh, and when you got the rank, they didn't have a ceremony or anything. They gave you a little slip of paper, and you could go down to the PX and buy your stripes.
Buy yours.
Sew them on. The same with the we had gold wings from the navigation school.
Yeah.
We had to go buy our gold wings.
If you want to wear them, that's how you get them.
Yeah, right. So I made tech sergeant while I was on the mess duty, and the sergeant in charge of the mess hall didn't show up that whole week.
Really?
He did not come.
He just couldn't do it.
We just ran it.
So after your mess duty, then what was your assignment?
Back to flying, be a navigator bombardier on these planes, getting together to be sent over. So all of this had happened before the war ended.
Okay. And so when the war was over, then what happened?
Well, they grounded us.
Uh-huh.
We just had duty in the big, I remember I was sent to one of the big warehouses where they had all kinds of stuff stacked up to the ceiling. As a matter of fact, I dreamed that one of these big stacks fell on me and crushed me, and that I died. I was just going up sideways. I dreamed that. And
pretty vivid.
Yeah, I still remember it. So, and why, there was no reason that it didn't seem to be dangerous. I never thought of that, but that's what
it was,
what had happened.
Yeah.
And then they picked a group of us and sent us to China.
They tell you what it was for?
Nope. As a matter of fact, they sent some navigators, and they also sent some other troops. And I was put in charge of I was a tech sergeant, and I guess all the other techs had about 15 men I was in charge of to get to the West Coast.
I see.
So we went on trains to San Diego and got on a big troop ship there and went across on a ship. And they had these R4Ds, which was the DC-3 in civilian life, and the, I've forgotten what the Army called them, but anyway, we call them R4Ds, the Navy. And they had several on the deck of the ship. And so we went over all the way without stopping to China. Mm-hmm. And we went to Tsingtao, T-S-I-N-G-T-A-O, Tsingtao,
okay.
China.
Okay.
And that's where the Marine Air Base, one of the Marine Air Bases was. And so we were to navigate these cargo planes out of there. And immediately when the World War II was over, the communists in China took over all of China except for some of the coastal cities.
I see.
The nationalists still controlled what they call Peking then, Beijing now, and the railroad to Tientsin, and they controlled Tsingtao and Shanghai.
Mm-hmm.
So we, the Marines, were there sort of helping them and getting intelligence and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And so we navigators navigated planes up and down the China coast and over to Japan and Okinawa.
Mm-hmm.
And we were there about 6 months.
Really? And some of this was cargo and some of it was personnel? And...
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And there were some pretty interesting incidents. As a matter of fact, the Marines had some enlisted pilots. Master Sergeant pilots.
Mm-hmm.
One of my trips to Shanghai was with two Master Sergeants as pilot and co-pilot, and I was a Tech Sergeant Navigator, and I had a Buck Sergeant mechanic who stayed with the plane all the time.
Uh-huh.
Otherwise, we were not assigned to planes. It's just whatever plane was available.
Uh-huh.
Except the mechanic stayed with it.
Yeah.
And he flew with it. He took care of it mechanically.
Mm-hmm.
But we didn't know who the pilot was going to be, or they didn't know anything. It was all very impersonal, the crews.
Sure.
And we flew into the big airport at Shanghai, and only enlisted men got off that plane. And I recall that comments made by some of the Army who were... lieutenants and captains and all. They could hardly believe that this Marine plane had just been flown by enlisted men. But that's the way it was.
Yeah.
And on one of my trips to Japan, I spent about a month in Japan, really.
Whereabouts?
At the southern island of Kyushu, which was just 15 miles from Nagasaki.
Mm-hmm.
Hiroshima was further west and north, but Omura was the name of this place, and it was a former air base, but all the runways had been bombed by
sure.
people in the Sure. So we used a clover field to land in. Landed in a big clover field. The first time we landed there, I got out and there was a four-leaf clover.
See? See?
Yes. And the Japanese barracks were so, they were simple but beautiful. The Japanese had flowers and plants and beautified where they lived. And they had hot baths and
how wonderful.
Yeah, it was. They just had a way of beauty with them. And at one account there, and the young people, the children who went to school, and there was a school very close, you could see them out. They were all very friendly. And even the ex-soldiers were friendly.
I had heard that.
Yeah, they were. But the old people would not even look at us. You walk down the street, they would not look at us. Yeah. They would just completely ignore us. And one time, one of the ex-soldiers was in this, we were in a Quonset hut, and I was the navigator. There were two or three other lesser ranks there, and they opened one of their, a building that had a cabinet, and it had a lot of these swords, samurai,
yes.
Big samurai swords.
Yes.
And so they let us each have one. So I picked out one. And I took it back to the hut, and I was showing it to the others and to this Japanese soldier. And he said, and he spoke English. He said, I'll show you how to do the manual of arms with it. Mm-hmm. And so I gave him this sword, and he pulled it out of the sheath, and he started doing something, and I realized he could cut all of our heads off if he wanted to.
Yeah.
And so I walked over and picked up, we were all armed with carbines, little carbines. We got a carbine, put a bullet in the round. He just laughed and laughed. But I realized that
you'd turned over a weapon.
Yeah. But he had just thought it was so funny that I did that. And also on the base there were these arches, religious arches.
Yes.
And there was money under them. And I was looking at one of them and picking up some of the money and looking at that Japanese money.
Yeah.
And an adult came by and said, "You Christ that bus." another incident in China was I guess it was in Tsingtao. Really, I was just walking down the streets by myself, and I saw a flag hanging out over just a little storefront type thing, and it was a red flag with a black swastika on it. And I thought, what in the world is that doing here?
Yeah.
So I went down there and went in, and it was a religious place. And the two men who were Chinese, and they spoke a few words of English, and I spoke a few words of Chinese. And they had a little shrine to Christianity at a cross, Buddha, and all the others, about seven or eight different religions. And they obviously accepted all the religions. And on the dome of this little place, there was a sort of a dome ceiling, and they'd made it a dome, and a painted face with a smiling Chinese face. And they pointed up and said, "God." So I looked at it and thanked them. And they didn't try to proselytize me or anything. Mm-hmm. But as a matter of fact, I became an agnostic.
Did you?
Mm-hmm. Still am.
Tell me how that happened.
Well, I got to thinking. They accept all of these religions, many of which are contradictory to each other. And I learned later that it's the Taoist, T-A-O-I-S-T.
Yes.
And I got to thinking that here I was, a Bible-carrying Baptist, sort of half educated with it, but I knew all, I'd read the Bible through. And that it isn't very likely that it was anything more than the Greek mythology.
Mm-hmm.
That I got to think about all these different religions. And
mm-hmm.
I'm still interested in religion, but I'm an observer and not a believer.
It's one thing to read about it. It's another thing to...
I've read the Bible twice and the Quran twice. I've read mm-hmm. it through. And I've read about Buddhism and Shintoism and also read the Bhagavad Gita.
Mm-hmm.
And so, but that's been later.
So you believe...
What do I believe?
Yeah, what do you believe?
I believe that we're not intelligent enough to know the truth. And I think that all of the dogma of all the religions, including Christianity, is man-made.
Is man-made.
Hmm.
And in your deepest heart, what do you think happens to us when we die?
I think we go to the earth. Mm-hmm. I'm going up in a puff.
I bet it's going to be a really beautiful puff.
But yes, I think that religion is fine. I belong to a church, actually. That's another long story. But I do belong to a Methodist church just because my wife grew up as a little girl in Columbia, South Carolina. She was brought up by her grandmother mm-hmm. right across from a Methodist church. And the grandmother always took her to church and Sunday school and stuff.
And it was important to them.
Yes. So I met her at the University of Florida
mm-hmm.
when I was there post-war.
Well, now let's not skip any. So when you were in China, how long was that assignment?
About 6 months.
And then were you discharged from there?
Brought back from there. We came back on a ship
mm-hmm.
also. Across country on trains
uh-huh.
to Camp Lejeune, North Carolina, and I was discharged there. And I went home. And that's when the disaster was there waiting for me.
Yeah.
My mother was schizophrenic, paranoid. My father had a stroke. My 10-year-old brother was trying to hold things together. And my best friend, who had been in the Army Air Corps as a tail gunner on a bomber, had bought a plane. He had gotten out before I got back from China.
Mm-hmm.
And he had bought a plane. He was flying the first week, wrecked and was killed. And he had already, we could communicate, we wrote each other, and he had already done all the paperwork for me to start college with him. It was the 26th of August that I came home,
mm-hmm.
and first of September, or first week of September, we were to start.
What year?
That was 46.
1946, okay.
And so he had already arranged for me to go to this Presbyterian Junior College
mm-hmm.
about 25 miles from Elizabethtown. And we buried him, and I decided to go on up there. So I went there and came home every weekend.
Did you anticipate what you were going to find? Did you learn from letters
no,
before you got
I
home?
I had no idea.
It just unraveled.
It was obvious immediately.
Yes.
My mother had a loaded rifle in the living room.
Mm-hmm.
My brother said she had tried to run over the local doctor. She thought he was doing things to her. She was really paranoid. And so I spent every weekend at home, and I had to take her to a mental hospital.
Yes.
First, and I had accumulated a good bit. I sent all my money home. I didn't spend a quarter a month. There just wasn't anything that I needed.
No.
And so I had accumulated, and they put it in a bank in the family's name, actually.
Mm-hmm.
And so it actually used up about $1,000, which was a lot at that time for a month at this mental hospital, and they gave her shock treatment, and she became zombified and couldn't remember anything, but she was not paranoid anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So we went on for a few months, and she became paranoid again, and I consulted with the town doctor, and we decided she probably should go to the state hospital. So they arranged that, and I took her up, and I had to carry her in my arms. She would not go in, which was the worst part of my life.
I would think.
Yeah. And so she went in the big hospital there in Raleigh, and only a few months, and they were ready. They did the same thing. They were ready for her to go home and contacted me, and I got her. And then she wanted to come back down to Florida, where her sister lived. So I brought them all down to Florida and bought them a house.
Whereabouts in Florida?
It was at Ocean Way, just a little north of Jacksonville.
Mm-hmm.
And it had belonged to the owner of a little sawmill that was right beside the house. And actually, when it came down, I got a job loading slabs. And
really?
And then I went over to the UF and signed up there too. So
University of Florida in Gainesville. Yeah. Well, now, how was your father doing?
He was better. He actually was driving some, but he shouldn't have been.
Mm-hmm.
He drove maybe for a few more months, and then he had a wreck. And that was the last of it driving.
Yeah.
And so, and my mother also got bad again. And so I took her up to, I got in charge of it with a doctor who arranged for her and who examined her. And also they had to have a citizens committee to question her.
Yes.
And so they did that and mm-hmm. agreed that she needed to be hospitalized. Mm-hmm. So I took her up to Chattahoochee.
Mm-hmm.
Spent the rest of her life.
Yeah.
In Chattahoochee.
And was that a long life?
She lived to be 88 years old. And uh-huh. She was in the hospitals 40 years.
Mm-hmm.
She was 48 when I came home from Marine Corps.
Mm-hmm.
And I would go and visit her and
yes.
bring her home once in a while, but yeah. She could not tolerate being out.
Yeah, I was going to say that's hard mm-hmm. when they yeah. get used to the structure of what they know.
So that was it. Her disabilities and my father's disabilities. And
did your little brother do all right then?
My little brother is very malleable, and he helped. And he lived, when I finished at UF in 49, he lived with my sister, who was back at Waynesboro, Georgia then, in a mm-hmm. stable situation. He lived with her. But they had a problem, I think, something had happened to them financially, and she said I'd have to look after him. So I had already finished at the UF, and I was a welfare worker with the state welfare department. I was a caseworker in Stark.
I see.
And my brother came down, and we stayed there about a year. And also at at UF, I met my wife. And from the time I left high school to go to do that stuff at the shipyard, which was 10 hours a day, 7 days a week, and going back in the little, back and forth little buses. From the time I left high school until I was a senior at UF, I didn't have a date.
Busy life.
Yeah. It was busy, and of course.
So you were how old when you met your wife?
I was 20 or 21. 21 probably. Mm-hmm. And she was a graduate student at UF. Mm-hmm. And I was working in the serving line in the university cafeteria.
Yes.
And she came through usually with some of the professors, and she always ordered an avocado salad. So sometimes they were out. So I started saving the salads for her. So that's how she noticed me.
One does what one has to do, doesn't one? What graduate program was she in?
English.
English. Yeah. Okay.
She majored in chemistry, mm-hmm. At the University of South Carolina. Was graduated summa cum laude. Mm-hmm. I am very emotional about her. She died. But anyway.
What year did she die?
74.
Mm-hmm. And how many children do you
we
have?
We had five children. Mm-hmm. And my brother Ben, came and lived with me at Year Stark, and he went to high school there. And we lived only a block from the school, and the National Guard Armory was on the corner right across from the school. I was making $200 a month, and my brother Ben, who was, I think, 14 then or something, said, Ed, why don't you join the National Guard and you could get some extra money. They only have to go there once a month. Mm-hmm. And I thought about that, and I thought, well, that's reasonable. And mm-hmm. So I did that, joined the National Guard, and they made me a second lieutenant. And then the Korean War broke out. So every weekend was spent at Camp Blanding.
Oh, yes.
I was the ANP platoon leader and then the communications officer for the regiment. And so it was every week. But they never did call this division up, strangely enough.
Really?
But I made more money in the National Guard than I did for the job. And yeah. The reason I got the job at Stark was that I wanted to be close so I could see Barbara. Yeah. She was still finishing her thesis and all.
Yes.
And the professors there told me that she was the best they'd ever had.
Well, when you were in the National Guard, now how long was that?
Oh, it was a couple of years or something.
And you were?
Then when Barbara and I were married.
Yes, and that was what year?
50, I guess.
Okay.
I was graduated in 49.
Graduated From
UF.
Okay, now we skipped getting into UF. When did you start in UF?
As soon as I brought the family down to Florida.
Oh, and you were working in Stark?
No, that was later. I was when I brought the family down and bought this little house at Ocean Way, I came over.
And went to school then? No, I'm sorry, I'm interrupting you.
I enrolled at UF.
Okay.
And
you finished 4 years?
Yeah, I finished the degree in 49.
Okay.
Actually, it only took me 3 years to get through.
And so that's when you went over to Stark, after you graduated?
Yes.
I got you. Okay.
And I actually went to Jacksonville looking for a job, and they told me I needed to go and finish school. And I said, I finished. I have my degree. So they tested me for the State Department of Things, and I made high marks on all that. And so they gave me a job. My request is Stark.
Yeah, so that was convenient.
So I was a caseworker for the welfare department.
Let's just say they didn't need a bombardier.
And
well, did you like the casework?
Not particularly. I was getting to every black family in Bradford County.
I bet.
They were all on welfare.
I bet.
And a lot of the white ones. Well, this was in 49, 50.
Probably depressed area.
And yes. And a lot of them were old age assistants. There was FDIC. Yes. Mm-hmm. And then Barbara and I were married, and she came and lived at Stark with me, and my brother Ben went to live with my sister again in Waynesboro.
Okay.
And I was sort of bemoaning the fact there was no future in the job I was in. And Barbara said, well, what would you like to do? And I said, well, I would really be interested in medicine, but I haven't prepared for it. I don't have any of it. She said, we'll go back to UF and you just get all the necessary things.
And was she working at the time?
No. She said, I'll get a job at the library, and she did. And also, I was in the National Guard to Camp Blanding every weekend.
Yes.
Making more than I'd made in my job at Stark.
Yeah. I bet.
Strangely enough. So that sort of put us through.
Yes.
And it took two semesters for me to get the
prerequisites. Mm-hmm. I'll be darned.
It was as hard as medical school.
I think that's true.
Physics, organic chemistry, stuff I hadn't taken.
Yes.
And so
that was a totally different path from anything you'd.
And I had no idea there would be any problem getting in medical school.
And but was there?
Yeah.
Was there?
I applied to four schools and got just a form letter.
Really?
From each of them except one. And that was Bowman Gray at Winston-Salem Wake Forest College. And they asked me to come up, and so I was interviewed by a surgeon, and he said, I see all your paperwork. He said, what else are you interested in? And I'd gotten interested in birds, bird watching.
Yeah.
So we talked about birds for 30 minutes, and he said, you're in.
Interviews are something else sometimes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm sorry I'm so emotional about all this. I haven't thought about it all now.
You go back over some of this for a while.
And
well, if you want to take a break, or if we want to maybe make an appointment and do another session, whatever is your choice. You doing all right?
What time is it?
I don't know.
Well, maybe we should make another appointment.
All right. I think so.